Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins, and unfortunately, Kathleen cannot be with us today. We also don't have a special guest, so it'll be an hour of me. But I hope that, nevertheless, in this hour or so, I'm planning on covering three topics. Jesus' wife, the famous discovery recently announced, Bosnian pyramids, and some update on a book by Robert Bovell and Ahmed Osman, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, the conspiracies to suppress the voice of ancient Egypt. But first, of course, international headlines have been dominated by a business card size revelation. Basically, a piece of 4th century material upon which a few words have been written, which points out at two things. One, that Jesus had a wife, and that the wife was amongst the disciples. And of course, the third aspect of this is that that person has been identified as Mary, leaving very little doubt that the person responsible here is Mary Magdalene. Now, for regular listeners or people familiar with the work of Kathleen, my wife, they will know that she has been at the forefront of rallying the cry that Mary Magdalene was Jesus' wife, and that there is extensive evidence across the world which underlines this belief or this fact. The Cathars specifically, actually, apart from being a heretical cult, also had very specific beliefs about the fact that Mary Magdalene was Jesus' companion, and they were really hunted down for this. And some of the dates of the Cathar Crusade specifically targeted July 22nd, the feast day of Mary Magdalene, because of their belief that she was the wife of Jesus Christ. So, for centuries it has been believed, and now it appears that there is once again evidence coming out. And so the newspapers and the online services and even the likes of Jon Stewart of The Daily Show have been reporting on this little piece of information. But as you can imagine, after the original announcement, there has been the usual backlash of skeptics and people who want to see their name in print as having an opinion of their own, because isn't that the way science is supposed to work? So unfortunately, what we've had over the last week or so after the initial announcement is a number of dissenters, people who are trying to make this go away. And the reason for that is clearly obvious, because the background of this story is very simple. There were various opinions about the life of Jesus and his personal life. And then in the late 3rd century, or rather in the 3rd century, and enforced by force in the late 3rd century, this became more and more the so-called Christian dogma. Jesus wasn't married. There were only the four Gospels which were supposed to be the account of what truly happened. And we know that in the last few decades even, there has been an enormous amount of new discoveries being made. The Nag Hammadi scrolls, the Dead Sea scrolls, all of those materials were really secreted away in Nag Hammadi, which is in Egypt. Dead Sea scrolls obviously along the coastline of the Dead Sea. And they were secreted away for a very simple reason, which is that writings which were deemed to be heretical from there onwards were put into jars, into caves, into various other safe havens in the hope that they would survive the test of time. And that is also, of course, what happened with the discoveries of the Nag Hammadi writings and the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 1940s. So what we have here is basically archaeology being able to uncover some of the materials. And what we see in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the like of Michael Bagent and Richard Lee wrote about this in the Dead Sea Scrolls Deception, but there are various other books out there which basically will tell you that these writings were very much subjected to very careful scrutiny, and that from the very word go, the church tried to put its tentacles in there. They tried to control and they tried to delay the publication, the translation of these documents, because they knew that those documents was going to contain information which was going to be at odds with the doctrine of the church, because that is basically why 1600 years ago those documents were secreted in those caves. It's pretty much the people who realized that in the 4th century their voice was being silenced. They were hoping that at some point in the future their voice would once again be heard, and that is why they did what they did. And so what we know about these discoveries is that the church has always had a hand in this. The science approach will be that, of course, there's going to be good men like Father DeVoe, who was instrumental in the that sea scroll decipherment, and that obviously at some point these scientists will belong to the hierarchies of the church, and that it is not their fault that they are experts in translating things like Aramaic into French or English or other modern languages. But the sad fact of the matter is that that is a very, I would say, naive view of what has really been going on. And the signs were immediately there that what was happening last week was once again along the lines of what was happening here. The person in charge of this entire charade is a woman who has, first of all, a posting at Harvard, which I think says enough. And second of all, it's also somebody who has been a vociferous opponent of the Da Vinci Code, someone who is absolutely not convinced, isn't convinced by the arguments and the evidence that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene. And so for her to come out with this discovery initially was one of those questions as to what if she was going to basically say that a few years ago from now she was wrong, and that now that she had very strong evidence that this was clearly the errors of her way, and that she was now basically in possession of evidence which showed differently. Well, from her public statements, it's clear that she's not willing to go there. And definitely what's also been made clear is that Harvard at this moment in time isn't willing to publish her findings, which basically means that by not publishing her findings, this little piece of information will become not party of the scientific game, because basically what scientists are doing is that they have defined their own little game area, and for things to be part of that little play zone, it basically means that they have to have been published in peer-reviewed journals. And as long as Harvard isn't willing to do that here, it basically means that this information will not become part of the game zone, the play zone of the various scientists involved. Now, there have also been other things happening with this announcement. One of them is, of course, that there have been claims of fraud. And the fraud things have specifically come because the owner of this piece of material has been given the special privilege, so to speak, by the scientists involved as not having been identified. And so there are the usual and very straightforward and very simple and very basic allegations of some who basically say that simply because we do not know the owner, therefore this piece of material cannot be believed, that this might be a ploy to inflate the price, that he's doing it for the money. But that really is, a very basic and a completely unscientific reaction. And all the scientists involved in making such claims really should wonder whether, that notion comes anywhere into the fact that if you are sitting on a Botticelli, a Da Vinci, or anything like that, whether or not your name is mentioned or not has nothing to do whether a painting is or isn't a Botticelli or a Da Vinci. It has purely got to do with whether that painting is or isn't. And so what we see are, once again, various diversionary tactics. And some of these diversionary tactics are pretty much there simply because, again, there is an awful lot of containment to be done. And to a large extent, I would say that there is this notion out there that a week in, it is this piece of material against the world, the truth against the world, literally. And that is very much the case, but this piece of material is already in the possession of the enemy, so to speak. The scientists involved have no interest in the truth. They are interested in playing the scientific game, into making a name for themselves and seeing whether this piece of material can advance their career. That is really all the effort which is going to go into this. And at the same time, by pretending to be scientific, they are going to create debate about this piece. But the piece in Origins is very simple. The piece in Origins, unfortunately, parts of it are missing, and I hope that parts of it are going to come out at a later moment in time. But really, what is going on there is that this is part of the verification process, so to speak, of things which are already known. For example, there's discussion about a wife. Whatever Jesus is saying about his wife, the important thing is that he is referring to somebody as his wife, and pretty much this excludes out all male company, so he's clearly talking about a female person. He refers in that same section to somebody called Mary, and it's likely that this is the name of his wife. And then, of course, he also says that his wife is amongst his disciples. And by everything which we know about those early days, there is really only one candidate, and that is Mary Magdalene. And it is interesting, of course, that she is the one who continues to be an eyesore in the face of the Catholic Church, because for thousands of years she has been used as a scapegoat. She has been used as a means of basically putting us down. What happened a few centuries ago was that the worship of Mary Magdalene was always very popular. And I think actually what happened was that the church at one point decided to do something about it. They realized that she was too popular to remain on the outskirts of their territory. And so they brought her in. But they couldn't bring her in under the truth, because the truth had been excluded in the 4th century. She couldn't be the wife of Jesus. So they brought her in as a whore who was penitent. And because the Catholic Church so loves the fact about original sin, which, basically, let's face it, that's the premise of Catholicism. So what they did was they decided to make her the example of the fact that even a whore who was penitent could become a symbol of repentance. And the fact that, Jesus forgave her showed how good and how open he was, that he welcomed everybody within his community. Well, the fact that it was his wife probably means that she wasn't a whore. So what we have there is an interesting situation. And I think that is really what is at the core of an awful lot of the problems. It's the fact that the church has to go from having depicted her as a whore, even though they now claim that this is erroneous and they should never have done so, to having her depicted as not only the wife of Jesus, but also as one of the disciples. And that, of course, is where it becomes really scary for the church, because as we know, the church is going into this more conservative zone. And this is something which is happening in an awful lot of environments. And the reason for why it is happening is simply to do with the fact that whenever somebody feels that their power is shrinking, they go to a more strict doctrine in the hope that that will make the belief system survive. And that is definitely what the church is doing. They realize that they are in trouble. They realize that their numbers are falling. And books like Kathleen's The Expected One actually had a tremendous impact in countries such as Brazil. And Brazil was a country where the church always felt that, I think, it was relatively safe. Large sections of those people are Catholics, and there was really not anything to suggest that it was going to be any differently. But the fact that books like The Da Vinci Code and Kathleen's The Expected One really had an impact in some zones where the church thought it was going to be okay, really began to question them. And what we see now is really like the next step. It's been roughly 10 years since The Da Vinci Code, and all of these things seem to have waves of 10 years, whether they're crop circles, UFOs, ancient aliens, or things to do with alternative interpretations of Christianity. And so it seems that we're once again at the start of a wave which is going to push for questions as to whether or not Jesus and Mary Magdalene have been married. And the first really input has come from a woman who's part of the establishment. And again, going slightly back against this, or towards this notion that this is a little piece of, not paper, but you know, figuratively speaking, paper against the world. Unfortunately, the game at this moment in time is completely being played by academics. There's no room for any alternative researcher in there. This is a closed by invitation only game, the way it is being played. And it'll be interesting to see how this is going to evolve over the next few weeks and months, whether this story is going to disappear or whether it is somehow going to remain, or and how it is going to survive the initial onslaughts. But I think one of the problems here is not so much the fact that Mary was married to Jesus. I think really the big problem is in the other line, which is that she was one of his disciples. Because it really means that for specifically the Catholic Church, it is a challenge to the way they are organized. It really is a challenge whereby they say, whereby it's become apparent that if this is true, then the Church really should open itself up to women and women in the priesthood. And that is something which basically the Catholic Church is pretty much never going to allow to happen, I'm afraid, in the near future. So it'll be interesting to see how it is playing out this game. At the same time, of course, even the professors involved have said that this isn't necessarily proof of anything, that this is only an indication that people in the 4th century believed that Jesus was married. But as Kathleen has been pointing out, all of this information in that document actually is quotes. It's quoted material from Jesus. Jesus is referring to somebody as his wife. Jesus is referring to this person as one of his disciples. And so it is pretty much a bit more than just somebody in the 4th century believing that Jesus was married. It is somebody in the 4th century, if not before, and we'll come back to that in a second, writing down that he believes or she believes that Jesus was saying this a few centuries before. And even though the document is believed to have dated or is dated from the 4th century, there's actually some information, and even the people involved believe that the information might rely to a source which goes back to the 2nd century BC, bringing it very close to the time frame of the events happening. And so it's an interesting time, and we'll see what happens with the story, and we'll definitely come back to it as soon as we can get Kathleen back on the air. So more to be done there, and we'll hope that the story is going to continue over the next few weeks or so. And as usual, we would like to hear your opinions. And we would maybe even like to hear if you are one of those people who goes regularly to church or has contact with people within the church. What is their opinion about this discovery? How is it affecting them? Are they willing to talk about it, or are they instead choosing to basically remain quiet about it and not bring it out into the open? So, that is one piece of controversy. The other piece of controversy has to do with a somewhat recent book, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, by Robert Bovell and Ahmed Osman. And the subtitle of this book is The Conspiracy to Suppress the Voice of Ancient Egypt. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with these two authors, Robert Bovell is the author of The Orion Mystery, one of the books in the 1990s, which said that the Great Pyramid of Giza was linked with the Orion constellation. And Ahmed Osman is an Egyptian man who has lived most of his life in London. He has written a number of controversial books, For example, one in which he identifies Moses with Akhenaten, another one in which he claims that Tutankhamun had actually been murdered, and some other ones in which he claims to have identified Joseph as one of the viziers in the court of ancient Egypt. Now, we're hoping to get some of the authors on our show over the next few weeks, but what became apparent over the last week by reading this book and by working on an upcoming book of mine, which is The Atlas of Ancient Enigmas. The Atlas of Ancient Enigmas basically delves into places across the world where there are, guess what, ancient enigmas. And a few of them are obviously located in Egypt. And when I was going through some of the material and seeing whether I needed to update something, I came across an incident which happened a few years ago, in which at that moment in time, and we're talking here about 2008, I was asked not to speak about, and I was looking on the internet to see what had happened since. And basically in 2008, a Belgian artist called Louis de Cordier worked with Ghent University, a Belgian university, and a NRIAG, a company in Cairo, and they basically scanned, with all the permits in place, an area near the Hawara Pyramid. And it is in that area that it is believed that there is the old labyrinth. And to give you a bit of background on that, the labyrinth of ancient Egypt was reported as one of the great wonders of the ancient world. Herodotus wrote about it extensively. And in the 19th century, Flinders Petrie, and actually at the beginning of the 20th century as well, Flinders Petrie began to do excavations. And what he found was a giant slab measuring roughly 300 yards by about 150 yards. And he believed that what he had found was the foundation of the Serapeum of the labyrinth. Sorry. And he basically reported that all the stones of the labyrinth had been used in constructions elsewhere and that nothing remained of that. But ever since, and even he had some doubts still left, ever since there was a suggestion, a possibility, that actually what was going on might not be the fact that it was the foundation, the floor of this labyrinth, but actually the roof. And so what happened was that in 2008, this team did surveys using georadars and various other equipment. And they were able to identify that there are indeed structures underneath this slab of stone. And specifically, that the geophysics results showed that this was in the shape of a structure which is conformed to the descriptions given by Herodotus and various others of the labyrinth, basically walls, corridors at 90 degree angles. And so in 2008, de Cordier finished his analysis, the teams involved wrote up their report, and being an outsider, de Cordier made a very brief announcement in the summer of 2008, and a public lecture at Ghent University in October of 2008. And it was around that moment in time that I was asked that, even though if I heard about it, that I was asked to keep quiet about this. Because what had happened was that in 2008, in October of 2008, de Cordier announced the findings that he had rediscovered the labyrinth of Herodotus in Hawara. And as soon as he had done so, he received threatening letters from, at that moment in time, Dr. Zahi, who was, at that moment in time, the head, the chairman of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, in which he basically said that he had not given the go-ahead for the publication and revelation of this information, and that until he did so, the team was supposed to remain quiet, and that if they didn't, that there might have been serious repercussions for the people involved, which basically means that the people involved would have been allowed or disallowed access to Egyptian antiquities or further work on archaeological sites in Egypt. And for 2 years, until 2010, the Cordier and his team adhered to this silence. But then they decided to nevertheless publish these findings. And fortunately, because of the two-year delay, and in the manner in which the information was published, which was basically a quite straightforward announcement on the website of the organization, the news really didn't have the required impact. And that was, of course, you know, sad. But as a result of that, 2 years later, we're still in a situation whereby very little is known about the fact that indeed, 4 years ago, there was geophysics evidence of the fact that there was, you know, that the labyrinth had been rediscovered. Now, reading Robert Bovell and Ahmed Osman's Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, this is just one example, and this example is actually not listed in the book, but it is one example out of so many which clearly show that over the last 30 years, something truly disastrous has been happening in ancient Egypt, and that pretty much we can tie it all back to one man, which is Dr. Zahi Hawass. Hawass has been, since the 1980s, involved in making sure that the truth of ancient Egypt has not been allowed to come out, first of all, on the Giza Plateau, and second of all, since he became the chairman of the Supreme Council of Antiquities in 2002, for everything in Egypt. For people who've been following him on television, they will see, have seen him in maybe such productions as Chasing Mummies, which ran on the History Channel. And in one of the latter episodes there, you can see him talking to a female archaeologist called Dr. Kathleen Martinez, who has certain opinions as to where she thinks the body of Cleopatra might have been located. And on camera, we can clearly see that Hawass is refusing to listen to her or to give her certain permits because he believes that the body of Cleopatra is somewhere else. And in his case, you know, pretty much impossible to recover because he feels that she is somewhere within the waves of the Mediterranean Sea. That is just one aspect of how he has been behaving. We'll come in the next section to the Bosnian pyramids. And in 2006, Dr. Samos Manigic, the project lead, the director of the foundation who is running the archaeological excavations at the Bosnian Valley of the Pyramids, wrote to Dr. Zahi Hawass basically saying that he hoped to get from Egypt a geologist who was able to help him in identifying whether the pyramids in Bosnia were natural geological formations or whether they were man-made. And he got a letter back from Dr. Zahi Hawass basically saying that the man for the job was Dr. Ali Barakat, who duly came to Bosnia, who stayed for 42 days, and at the end of that time frame presented his findings, which were that the Bosnian pyramids were man-made. Now, we'll come to that in the next session as well, but because of the controversy which erupted about this, various people, various archaeologists basically wanted to pretend as if this had never happened. And so when they contacted Dr. Hawass about this, he basically said that he had never said any such thing, that he had never offered the services of Dr. Ali Barakat, and that Sam Osmanagic was inventing it all. Well, fortunately for Sam Osmanagic and unfortunately for Hawass, he had done so in writing. And so when Osmanagic produced the letter, it clearly identified that Hawass had been involved and had identified and had recommended Barakat as the man for the job. And it was only when Barakat came away with a conclusion which was very unfortunate for the likes of Hawass that he tried to pretend as if nothing had happened. Again, for people who've read Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, this will be something which really fits within the character of the man who Bovell and Osman are exposing. And I find it interesting that this is a man who, you know, is very big on saying that Egypt should be the bailiwick of archaeologists and Egyptologists, but he himself isn't one. In fact, there are numerous examples of where he has displayed horrific approaches to science and academic doctrines as such. most famously is probably when he and actor Bill Pullman kicked the sarcophagus open rather than use any of the more tools provided for such a job. But also, of course, the entire unscientific nature of the way he goes about things, and specifically the way he has been withholding information. For example, since the 1980s, it's a known fact that there are carbon dating results which show that the Great Pyramid and the pyramid next to it, allegedly from Khafre, are 500-700 years older than the established dating. They are pretty much dated to about 3100 BC. Also, that the Great Pyramid is of more recent origins than Khafre, which is basically turning the sequence of pyramid building on that plateau on its head. Unfortunately, despite the fact that these carbon dating results have been known since three decades, they have never been published within a peer-reviewed journal, which means that for three decades, Egyptologists have been getting away almost literally with a crime against history. Because what has been happening is that these people have been able to pretend that these results of the carbon dating tests should not be taken into account, because guess what? They have not been published in a peer-reviewed journal. And this is, of course, a little game which scientists get away with, whether it is with a papyrus involving Jesus's wife or whether it is with carbon dating results involving basically the dates of the pyramids. And it is a game which they play. But there's also another interesting aspect which I have been aware of, but I think it needs to be occasionally re-aired, because in 1997, Clive Prince and Lynn Pigment had just finished the Temple of Revelation, and at that moment in time were thinking as to where to go next. And at that moment in time, the very logical conclusion was Egypt. And so Clive and I began to do an enormous amount of research, which became eventually published as The Stargate Conspiracy. And in there were a few chapters which the likes of Nick Redfern in The Pentagon and the Pyramids, or rather The Pyramids and the Pentagon, a recent book, and Robert Bovall and Ahmed Osman in Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, have gone beyond and have also incorporated. And it's basically the fact that both Mark Lehner and Zahi Hawass in the 1980s were supported by the Edgar Cayce Foundation. Basically what happened is that several decades ago, Edgar Cayce prophesied that near the Sphinx, writes Paul, there would be found a cavity in which there would be evidence of a hall of records, which would have evidence of Atlantis, which would show that this mythical civilization was actually true. And ever since, the descendants of Cayce, specifically his son, Yu Lin, who has since passed away as well, if I'm not mistaken, he tried to get an enormous amount of people interested in this. And in the 1970s, he actually got the cooperation of Stanford Research International involved and was allowed to do certain things. But in the 1980s, the game was stepped up. Mark Lehner, who is now one of the leading American Egyptologists, as a young child, was very interested in Cayce. His father and him grew up within a Cayce environment, and it is said that he actually became inspired to become an Egyptologist by Cayce's prophecies. His education was partially sponsored by the Cayce Foundation. He wrote about his Cayceite influence. Today, Lehner denies this, even though the documents which prove that he was interested in Cayce are on record. And it is somewhat interesting, not so much to see, everybody can be interested into something and then can let go of it for whatever reason, whether it's losing interest or finding out that there is something wrong with this. But in the case of Lehner, he has never really said that Cayce, in his opinion, was proven wrong. He's basically said that he never was exposed to this, which is a very weird attitude for somebody who is known, which can be proven to have been exposed to the Cayce material. Now, in the case of Zahi Hawass, what happened was that this man who seemingly had no great career ahead of him who had just gotten a job on the Giza Plateau as pretty much a low-level inspector, which basically means that he is there to guide people around. And in 1982, he was guiding around Mark Lehner, who was doing work on the Giza Plateau, and it is said that the two struck up a very close friendship, which we can definitely see, because the two of them have certain opinions about the Great Pyramid, its orientations and so on, which I personally find are very intriguing, and which I think are somewhat, you know, unknown out there, and which maybe should be better known. But anyway, in 1982, they began to have this friendship, the start of this friendship. And shortly afterwards, Hawass actually was entered for a PhD thesis at the University of Pennsylvania, a PhD which he attained in 1987. And the interesting aspect there, once again, is that it is now known that, according to Eulyn Casey, this was paid for by the Casey Foundation, by himself. Hawass has never denied the fact that the Casey Foundation has paid for his education. Hawass has gone on record as basically saying that he doesn't believe that the pyramids are older. He doesn't believe that the Sphinx is older. Equally interesting is, of course, that in 1992, the people involved with all of this, the Casey Foundation, people like Joseph Jehoda, Joe Shore, all of these people are very big promoters of Casey thinking that the Sphinx is older, that there is information about Atlantis present underneath the Giza Plateau. And in 1992, they were instrumental in sponsoring another man called Robert Schock, a geologist who has since gone on record as saying that, in his opinion, the Sphinx is indeed older. All of these stories about the Sphinx being older have come from one organization who definitely has a specific interest in promoting it. But one of the more interesting aspects which we explored in the Stargate conspiracy, and which unfortunately Boval and Osman haven't explored in Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, is the fact that these organizations also had various connections to the CIA. This is something which people are trying to not focus on, because it goes into a direction which really is a labyrinth, if ever there was one. It is a hall of mirrors for which no means of escape seem to be possible. But the fact of the matter is that it is all there. It is all a matter of public record that all of this in the 1970s was part of a larger whole, and that, for all we know, organizations like the Casey Foundation, Stanford Research International, both organizations with known links to the CIA, might have had a presence in Egypt which had little to do with archaeology, but more to do with the political situation which existed at this moment in time. There is so much more to be said about Breaking the Mirror of Heaven than I'm covering so far, and as I said, we're hoping to come back to this, hopefully with one of the contributors, whether it is Boval and or Ahmed Osman. But it is really an interesting book to read. It is a book which basically shows you and lays out the evidence against Hawass, and also shows you that there is very little which Hawass can defend himself with. It really gives a perspective that, in my opinion, it seems that we really need to look at the last 30 years of Egyptology and realize that, you know, we really have no way of knowing what's true and what is not. And I will come back to this at another moment in time. But about in 1998, 1999, there was somebody who was making extreme allegations against Dr. Zahi Hawass. And his name was an American from Los Angeles called Larry Hunter. And I was in contact with Larry Hunter. And again, I was following what he was saying, and he was making tremendous claims. He had claims, he had videotape, some of it which was crystal clear that Hawass was hiding information from the rest of the world. He had some information, as I said, on video. He had some written affidavits from people involved testifying against the fact, or about the fact, that Hawass was hiding information. And at that moment in time, I you know, was involved with this, and I was trying to get Larry to sort of go beyond and give me a bit insight into why he was making further allegations, which was basically that an entire series of cavities inside the Great Pyramid were known by Hawass for several decades, and that he was keeping the link in this. And at that moment in time, everybody, my fellow colleague researchers, basically told me that I should better stay away from Larry Hunter because that a storm was brewing. And sure enough, a very prominent researcher who, for the moment, will go unmentioned, at that moment in time made very personal and serious accusations against Larry Hunter, as a result of which Hunter shut up. And at that moment in time, I thought that the allegations against Hunter actually were sincere, and that this was the reason why Hunter disappeared for a while from the scene. But in retrospect, and reading Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, I feel that actually those allegations might not have been completely correct. That it seems that, you know, there was a very nebulous cooperation going on between various people vying for the envy, vying for the attention of Zahi Hawass. And whereas we constantly seem to think that there are two camps here, Hawass versus the alternative researchers with the likes of Robert Bofell, Graham Hancock, Robert Schock, and various others, that has definitely not always been the case. And for people who've been around in the 1990s, they know that the alliances within that camp have on occasion shifted. And I'm very sad to say that I might have been completely wrong about the role of Larry Hunter, and I hope to readdress the situation, unfortunately several years too late maybe, but never too late for the truth to come out, because if we can get more into that story, then there is definitely news to report on the Great Pyramid, certain discoveries which were made several years and several decades ago, and how the likes of Zahi Hawass has been instrumental in creating a smokescreen whereby the truth will, or was supposed to be, never come out. But as we know, it's the truth against the world, but also the truth coming out. Which brings us to the third aspect of today's show, which is the fact that we are back from Bosnia. And again, we hope over the next few weeks to have one of our special guests, Dr. Sam Osmanagic, the man who's instrumental in the pyramid work. I've gone to Bosnia four times now, once in 2007 and twice in 2008. And since 2008, I hadn't gone back until September of this year, for purely practical reasons, which basically stopped me from going to Bosnia. When I came there this year, it was truly a revelation. So much has happened specifically in the tunnel complex. And whereas in 2008, everybody was still in the mindset of trying to find out whether these pyramids were man-made or natural, so much material has been found. So many scientists have come, specifically from Eastern Europe, Russia, and those countries, which not only, you know, makes it clear that this is a man-made structure, but specifically that what is happening in Visoko, the little town about 20 minutes drive from Sarajevo, that it's clear that what these structures are is providing us with answers as to why our ancestors were building the pyramids. And what Sam has been doing is a careful shift. Over the last few years, Sam has been trying to find out why the pyramids were built. And he has brought some of the leading lights in various disciplines to Visoko to help him answer those questions. And amazingly enough, over the course of a few seasons of this kind of work, very advanced kind of research, certain answers are being discovered as to what is so special about this pyramid, but potentially all pyramids in the world, and how really there is a pyramid science. Questions as to, you know, this idea of pyramid power, which was reported several decades ago and which then disappeared again. Well, guess what? Some of the likes of the people involved in this research really have shown that there is a very simple possibility, a very simple answer as to why things like pyramid power might work. two people, Suleiman Mazdrak and Polo the Bertulus, are instrumental in discovering some of these things. And their findings have since been verified by other scientists who have come to Visoko. Specifically, what the team of has identified is that there is a kind of energy beam which is emanating from the pyramid of the sun. This is a beam of energy a few meters wide, and it shoots into the air. And also, this is not just an energy but also a sound beam, which is its intensity differs depending on the weather and the time of year. Now, they have also been able to show that what is going on here is of interest, because you would think that if I send out an energy signal to you, then the strongest energy will be on my side and the intensity will diminish as it goes away from the source. But what they have found in the case of the Pyramid of the Sun, that this is not the case, that actually the energy beam is more intense higher up than it is closer to the Pyramid of the Sun. And this is of interest because basically this suggests that this is not a standard beam, but that this is actually something more interesting. And obviously research in this is very new, and the answers are definitely not there for the grasping. But the team came back this year. The wave was found in 2010, was confirmed in 2011, and in April of 2012 they did further research. And basically what they are saying is that they are now that they have identified that this point of an energy beam has a point of importance roughly about 2 kilometers either up or down the pyramid. How they identified this was because, I'm not trying to be too technical here, so I'm going to go straight into the analogy. Basically what they realized was that this beam hit a mold of a surface of iron. Now, as we know that 2 kilometers up in midair there is no such iron deposit floating in midair above the Pyramid of the Sun, by default we can say that this iron deposit sits 2 kilometers down. And the way that this team has been envisioning this is that they believe that what is happening here is that pyramids act like the feed horns from satellite dishes. That basically the satellite dish is this metal plate sitting deep down, and that the pyramid is like the feed horn. And just like a satellite is able to emit and receive information through the energy collected from the satellite dish itself, they believe that the pyramid has a similar makeup. And they have been able to demonstrate this in the case of the Pyramid of the Sun. And it'll be interesting to see whether they are able to demonstrate this with other pyramids, provided, of course, that they have or are being given information and access to these sites. The technology involved, the setup into how they create these measurements is extremely complex and complicated and intricate. When they showed the setup which they had to do on the past 3 years on the Pyramid of the Sun, it truly makes it apparent that what is going on here is extremely detailed, extremely advanced kinds of measuring. But it is interesting to see that the Pyramid of the Sun and the pyramid complex in Bosnia as a whole is really pushing the envelope. And it's also pushing the envelope, of course, because the Pyramid of the Sun is the largest pyramid in the world. It is at least 220 meters high. The Pyramid of the Moon nearby is about 180 meters high. And in comparison, the Pyramid of Great Pyramid in Egypt, the Pyramid of Khufu on the Giza Plateau, is 150 meters high. So very much smaller than the pyramids of Bosnia. Almost immediately, the pyramids of Bosnia were deemed to be older than the pyramids of Giza as well, because they are within a catchment area of a civilization known as Old Europe, a civilization which existed from 6,500 to 3,000 BC. evidence of the civilization has been found in and near Visoko, and on an almost daily basis, more evidence of the presence of the civilization has been found. But over the last few years, there has been other evidence found, which basically suggests that these structures are older. Carbon dating results from the Pyramid of the Moon came back last year, giving a date of 10,000 BC. And this year, a soil sample from a excavation site on top of the Pyramid of the Sun came back with a date of 24,000 years ago, give or minus 200 years. So this is a very old dating, which clearly pushes it outside of the bailiwick of old Europe. But as Dr. Ricardo Brett from the University of Venice was saying, he's the lead archaeologist this year on the pyramid complex in Bosnia. When we look elsewhere, it is the time frame when elsewhere in Europe we see our ancestors making such monuments as Lascaux or the Venus of Lausanne. And so we know that our ancestors 20,000 years ago were extremely advanced and extremely interested in certain things. And it seems it is potential that the pyramids in Bosnia date back to such an old time frame. Now, it is only one carbon dating result, and I will be the first to say that carbon dating itself cannot be relied upon as giving a definitive answer. More carbon dating results need to be done. But it is definitely becoming clear that the pyramids in Bosnia are extremely old. That even though we think that they might be dating back to old Europe, that maybe actually they are older. And how old precisely is something which only the future will tell. But, you know, with each carbon dating test which is being done, more and more information is being gathered. Unfortunately, so much of the work which is happening in Bosnia is not aired properly. And for that, once again, we come to the fact that there is an academic embargo on the work being carried out in Visoko, one which was put in place by the likes of Hawass and Anthony Harding, at that moment in time, the president of the European Association of Archaeologists. In 2006 and 2007, they basically were instrumental in telling the world that what was happening in Bosnia was pseudoscience, that Dr. Samir Zmanagic, a man who has a PhD, who has three PhDs, that this man, you know, is not worthy of running this operation, and that what he is uncovering is not the truth, but that he is pretending something. My good old nemesis, Doug Weller of the Bad Archaeology, he has actually gone as far when he was confronted with the fact that there was an international conference on the Bosnian pyramids, which was attended by the leading Egyptologists, including the now current Minister of Antiquities, Dr. Mohamed Ibrahim Ali, who before that was the Dean of Archaeology of Enchains University. Mohamed Al-Shaheen, who was briefly a successor to Dr. Zahi Hawass, and who was the Dean of Archaeology for Cairo University. Basically, these two men are responsible for every Egyptologist who is being created as we speak. Well, those men came to Egypt. Those men were attending this conference. And Doug Weller basically said that this conference should be seen as being on par with creationist people who equally are holding conferences of no scientific merit whatsoever. Seriously, Mr. Weller? Seriously? But unfortunately, the likes of Doug Weller are instrumental in hiding behind the scenes, because they are the ones who are responsible for entries on Wikipedia which pretend that what is happening in Bosnia is a sham, and that everything which is in Bosnia to be seen is natural. If you go to Wikipedia, click on the talk page, which is a button, a tab on the top of each section, and see how Weller is trying to pretend that there is nothing going on in Visoko. Leading up to the tour, leading up to the conference which we did in September of this year, we heard time and time again how some people almost didn't come to Bosnia, because that day, when they started to Google it, all they came up with was apparent information that what was happening in Visoko was not true, and that somehow what was happening in Visoko was a sham, a hoax, if not, you know, a complete delusion or a fallacy. People who have come to Visoko will tell you that what is happening there is real. And I hadn't been there since 2008, and I can tell you that in 2012 it has become even more apparent that what is happening in Bosnia is extremely important, and that the pyramids are absolutely man-made. It'll take an awful long more before final answers as to dating and origins have been established, and to a large extent this has to do with the fact that this is a large project. This is the largest archaeological excavation happening in the world. The most amount of volunteers and helpers and aides in 2010 and 11 went to the Bosnian pyramid excavation. So what is happening in Bosnia is not only very important, but it's also something which I feel everybody should see with their own eyes. And I'm very fortunate that Sam has invited me back to speak next year at the Hidden History Conference on September 7th. And if you want to come to Bosnia with both Kathleen and myself, then you will be able to do so, because as this year, next year there will be a tour in the week leading up to September 7th. I'm speaking for Kathleen here, but she basically came to the conclusion 2 weeks ago that Bosnia was the hidden gem of Europe, that there is so much beauty to be seen, and that unfortunately, you know, few people come here, because still some people believe that in Bosnia people are shooting at each other, even though that is something which stopped in 1994. Since 1994, Bosnia has been a country of expansion, of new building, of trying to find its way in the new world, and the Bosnian pyramid complex is definitely an aspect of which shows how Bosnia is leading the way, and how the pyramid complex in Bosnia is leading the way in our understanding of to what pyramids can be. And so we hope to get Dr. Sam Osmanović on in the next few weeks, so we can interview him in more detail about what he has been doing and some of the controversies and the challenges which he has had to face, but which he has overcome with tremendous dignity, it has to be said. So we are reaching the end of this episode of The Spirit Revolution. I hope it wasn't too much of a monologue, and that it was nevertheless interesting. And if so, as usual, I hope to have you back on next week. If you want to hear me again in this episode, you can do so in a number of ways. As always, there is iTunes, there is our website, thespiritrevolution.com. If you want to help us, we are actually trying to have a makeover for our website. So if you have original artwork which you think would sit well and could become the logo of the Spirit Revolution, please send it in. Send it to info@philipcoppens.com. And that is PHILIPCOPPENS. info@philipcoppens.com. We will be back next week with another episode of The Spirit Revolution. But until then, from Kathleen and myself, the truth against the world.